Yeah, John.
I need to ask a question, so I could do it later, but let me do it now. It's this sense of what is it? And is it possible to say anything about what is it that is inviting and uplifting about what you see from this radical shift of perception? I mean, taking the Zen metaphor, you know, what's so great about being able to see the water around you? You know, what's so great about water? I mean, clearly, the people who were there hearing and seeing the Buddha can see that in him there was something that was really special, worth having. But is the answer, you know, what just, you know, follows the path and you see yourself in your experience? Are you able to give any clues as to what's so great? Because we're talking about something that's much more than just temporary relief that you get from when pain stops and suffering stops. I mean, there is something, some quality to it that when people talk about God or something that's much more inspiring, that they're alluding to. I wonder whether you'd like to say anything about that.
Yeah, well, I have a lot to say about that. Did you all hear the question? No. Well, basically, if I can paraphrase John, you know, what is the big deal about seeing one's ground? What is the big deal for a fish to see water? The Buddha, when he taught, must presumably have somehow embodied certain qualities that people found very appealing and attractive. They wanted to know more. So what is it then in seeing this ground or seeing this the nirvana or the dependent arising, whatever it is, that really could make a difference in our life, that's not just about a temporary release from discomfort or pain, but seems to be suggesting far, far more, that perhaps in other traditions they might speak of more positively in terms of God or something like that. Does that, that more or less summarises what you're saying? Well, I think the language I would use to answer that would again be to return to this idea of human flourishing. And I think that when we look at the Buddha as a person in the suttas, you have the sense that this is a man who's fully alive. And, you know, to such an extent that people would say, whoa, what's going on with him? There's something, I don't think he was a, you know, was drew people simply because he was in a constant state of deep meditative bliss the whole time, because frankly, that wouldn't be terribly interesting once you sort of got over the novelty of it. But here was a man who was totally alive, who was totally engaged in the affairs of his world. I'm not saying that he was, you know, political in that sense of, you know, actually interfering with government, but he clearly had a vision for what human life and human society could be. And I feel that in that sort of core sense, his example somehow spoke to people's deepest intuitions and yearning for how their lives could be. In other words, the Dharma, this, which is on the one hand this awareness that my life is conditional, contingent, and an awareness on the other hand that there are moments in this conditional and contingent life where I'm free not to just live according to my impulses and reactions and desires and fears. That is what opens up the possibility of another way of being in this world. In other words, it is the ground for a life in which we live fully, optimally, both in terms of how we think, how we speak, how we work, how we act, how we embody our values, how we pay attention. All of those things go together. So to me, the core of what the Buddha's trying to communicate is what is known technically as the Noble Eightfold Path. Now, normally, the Noble Eightfold Path is described as the Noble Eightfold Path that leads to the end of suffering. I think that leads to the end of suffering is probably tagged on later, as is the word noble, probably. We just have this word magga, path. And the path, I think, is a metaphor for a life that is lived at optimum capacity. It's not just about satisfying one's own selfish need to feel happy. I think it's a great mistake to reduce Buddhism to being happy. But it's more about a life that is infused with meaning and purpose, with empathy, with depth, with intelligence, with focus and concentration. And what the Buddha, I think, must have, and I'm guessing here because I wasn't there, but what the Buddha must have somehow embodied was that whole complex of values internalized and integrated into a human life. That, I think, I can't quite understand how, if that had not been the case, he would have had much impact. But what I think was his true genius was not just to somehow exhibit that possibility, but also to articulate not only what it constituted, but also how you might actually make changes in your own life such that these possibilities would emerge. And I think what's also implied in the term ehipasiko, inviting, is that at some level we kind of intuitively already know that. Now in later Buddhism this gets dressed up in words like Buddha nature. Now, we don't find that in the early text, and I don't really know whether it's even necessary to use that language. But the point is that someone like Sivaka is just some ordinary wandering mendicant, a sort of sadhu hippie type, in a very brief dialogue, the Buddha's able to say, you know this already for yourself. And I think when you have those moments in your life, they're sort of like moments like epiphanies. You suddenly realize, oh wow, I don't have to do all of this silly stuff. Like, you know, get distracted and indulge these fantasies and so on. I could live otherwise. And I think in order for that message to get through, it's not enough just for someone in authority to come and tell you that. You somehow have to wake up to that possibility within your own experience. Otherwise, it's just someone telling you what to do. So that's how I would take inviting. And what I find particularly, again, compelling is the word I would use, is that none of this requires the language of transcendence or God or ultimate grounds of being or anything like that. It's all phrased within basically an empirical language that can be, you know, the experiences of which can be tested and checked out through your own life. You don't need an overarching metaphysics of truth or reality or being. And I think why the Buddha said my teaching goes against the stream is not because, you know, he'd come to some understanding that was so incredibly refined that nobody else would get it. I think what he may have been saying is that what's distinctive about his teaching is not the content, but the style. Nowadays we call it a sort of pragmatic approach, not a metaphysical approach. Not one in which you need to believe certain basic tenets about the nature of reality in order that you can practice Buddhism, which is often the case in informal religious Buddhism. But he's rather saying, no, stop thinking that way, that you have to know about reality or being. The real challenge is to come to terms with your human existence, your dukkha, and to learn to respond to that from another perspective altogether. It's about engaging in a series of tasks rather than trying to persuade yourself of a certain set of truths. That's how I would make that distinction. Yes?
You just said there something I hadn't heard you say before, which was you responding to dukkha from a different place.
Yeah, that's right.
I've been fascinated by the kind of dukkha that the Buddha must have experienced from childhood upwards, as something that possibly set him up. Now, that's a long story, but it seems terribly relevant to everybody today to find a place from which to respond.
That's right. Yeah, well, see, that I think is what's going on here. And that place, again, I use the word, that ground, let's say, I've used place for something else, but we could switch them around, it doesn't really matter. What I think the Buddha is pointing out to in both of these texts is the ground from which we can learn to respond to dukkha from a totally different point of view. And that ground is nirvana, or the unconditioned, or the deathless. But those words have become so loaded with all kinds of religious belief and metaphysical projections, and a kind of just a sort of a usage, even in the Buddhist world, that raises them to some sort of privileged status. Have you noticed how nirvana, deathless, unconditioned, very often written with a capital letter at the front? Why? Have you ever seen the deathless or the unconditioned without a capital D and a capital U? There's no capital letters in Pali, Sanskrit, Chinese, or Tibetan. It's a very interesting habit that translators have to try to sort of ratchet up the importance of certain terms and say, well, this letter's got a capital U, therefore it's something special. There's no need to do that. In fact, I think that gets in the way. That introduces an element of privileging for something that actually is clearly visible here and now. Something quite ordinary that we just don't tend to see. It's difficult to see it because we're so preoccupied with other stuff. But when we did, if we were to see it, that could be the difference that makes all the difference.
It's quite big, really. I mean, it's almost worthy of capital letter.
Well, you could argue that perhaps, but I would actually like to dispense with this sort of privileging.
Yes.
I think it gets in the way. It also, for the basic, I think, you know, a very strong reason for not using it is because it's not actually there in the original. And I don't see why we should, you know, do this business. I'm sure people would justify it, capitalizing words, but frankly, I think it actually is distorting what is a much simpler fact that underlies these rather fancy expressions. Yes.
You made this interesting distinction between knowing and seeing.
Knowing and seeing, yeah.
Okay. Does that mean that for you, seeing wouldn't or doesn't, is a more sort of emotional experience? Or, well, I'm just trying to think, does that mean that we seeing something?
Okay, no, it's a good question. It has to do with, what would seeing have mean at this time, and how does it differ from knowing? That's your basic point, isn't it? One way we might look at this is that, you see, I wonder if this shift from place to ground was something comparable to what we call now a gestalt switch. You know, when you can see a vase, and then you look at it a little longer, and it switches into two faces. Or Wittgenstein's famous duck rabbit. You can look at a picture of a duck, look at it a bit longer, and it switches into a rabbit. Now that's, we wouldn't exactly call that knowing. That's a kind of modality of perceptional seeing. In other words, it's not just about, it's more emotional, but it's more intuitive. It's more, in some ways, more kind of holistic in a funny way. It's suddenly we come to see the world reconfigured in a way that we hadn't seen it before. And I wonder if we might actually, tease out this gestalt switch business to explain here this emphasis on seeing one's ground. It's not as though the ground is something that's never been there before. It's been there all along, but you've never actually quite configured your sense of who you are in terms of the duck of your ground as opposed to the rabbit of your place, we might even say. So perceptual switches, and I think a lot of Buddha's meditation is basically the training in perception. Instead of, we are basically programmed, for biological reasons probably, but also cultural ones, to see certain things as being permanent, to see certain things as being satisfactory, to see certain things as being me or mine. Now, very often, you know, Buddhist vipassana meditation is training yourself to know that things are impermanent, to know that they're dukkha, to know that they are anatta, they're not me, not mine. But again, is knowing really the right word? It's more, I think, a question of when you do these practices, you're basically training yourself to see the world in another way. You're training yourself to notice what you habitually don't see. It's more a training in perception and seeing than it is in gaining some sort of insight that the nature of reality is impermanent and dukkha and so on, which is often how Buddhism presents it. But I think that could well be a shift off into a kind of metaphysical direction to know the nature of reality, which I don't personally think the Buddha was remotely interested in. He was interested in learning, training people to see the world and themselves in a way that would enable their lives to be richer and fuller, more peaceful, more insightful, more empathetic. That's what matters, rather. He does use the word knowing, but he tends to, I mean, the term that I have in mind is the word parinya in Pali, which is the term he takes, it's the term he uses to describe the kind of knowing we have about dukkha. Dukkha, for those of you, literally means suffering, but it actually just is shorthand for the human condition, the state we're in, with a sort of emphasis on the tragic, poignant character of that condition. And when the Buddha, you know, explains, well, how do we first of all come to terms with this condition, he says, you need to fully know it. Parinya. Now, nya is to know, but he prefixes it with this word pari, P-A-R-I, and pari in Pali and Sanskrit literally means around knowing. In other words, it's a kind of knowing that's not homing in on a particular fact in that sort of conventional cognitive sense. Oh, now I know what you mean. But it's a knowing that tries to somehow experience what's going on from many different angles and perspectives, to get the view in the round, we would say. And I think the English word that fits rather nicely here is embrace. You embrace someone. In non-English European languages, they make a very crucial distinction between knowing a fact and knowing a person. Je sais quelque chose, mais je connais mon ami. And connaître, I think, is much closer to what the Buddha means here by knowing, or knowing in the round. It's a kind of intimate, empathetic embrace of our condition, rather than gaining, technically correct knowledge about it. I personally think that this business that, you know, impermanence and dukkha and not self as somehow the nature of reality that we need to know is actually missing something rather important. It's not so much, you know, getting to know that as a fact, but it's learning to, and that's why I use the word sensibility, perspective. These are all, to me, the practice of mindfulness, of awareness, of vipassana, is very much about reorienting one's whole being to the world in which one is a part, those other beings with whom one is in relationship. And that kind of knowing is not reducible just to, you know, knowledge. but it's something more to do with connaître, the kennen in German. And so in that sense, again, you can see how the Buddha's taking a word, jñā, to know, but qualifying it in such a way that it kind of goes beyond what we habitually think of as known. Now, as to, you know, what were the status of these words at the Buddha's time, I don't think we'll probably ever know that with any certainty. But what is quite clear to me is that he introduces a way of using words and language that suit the purposes of his teaching and his practice, that is very much about an engaged agency with our experience, rather than adopting a kind of detached theoretical stance, as some modern philosophers might put it. And I think what happened to Buddhism as it became a religion is that it started to privilege a kind of theoretical stance of knowledge. As enlightenment is usually, well not usually, but at least in the tradition in which I was trained, to be enlightened meant to gain a direct, non-conceptual pramana, or valid cognition of the absence of inherent existence of all things. In other words, you are liberated in traditional forms of Buddhism by gaining a specific kind of highly, you know, very well defined epistemological understanding of something that breaks the spell of your delusions and illusions. Again, Buddhism clearly developed in that direction, but I feel it's moved a long way from what we find in these early texts, frankly. I mean, when the Buddha speaks about emptiness, for example, he never speaks of knowing emptiness or understanding emptiness. Never. He always uses this word, viharati. Emptiness, you dwell in emptiness. Viharati can also mean you live in emptiness. Vihara means monastery, right? Basically means a dwelling, a living, an abode. And when he speaks in terms of emptiness, it's about a space in which you dwell and live. There's no knowing involved at all. And yet what happened in the course of the centuries is that emptiness becomes a privileged religious epistemological object that liberates you from delusion. Maybe it does. But it's not the way that the word is used in the early texts. Yes?
You mentioned that the first sutta, Majjhimanikaya 26, and the second sutta.
Anguttara Nikaya 647. It's the Patthama Sanditika Sutta. Anguttara Nikaya 647. So it's in the chapter of the sixes. Number 47. Again, Bhikkhu Bodhi's just translated the whole of the Anguttara. It's just come out a year or so ago. It's quite easy to find these passages. But of course, it's buried away in hundreds of pages of other stuff. Yes?
You sort of intimated the answer, but I'm kind of asking the same way I think Jesus would be kind of disappointed with the way Christianity has evolved. How would you see the Buddha in Buddhism as well? Intimated a bit earlier, just now.
If the Buddha were to walk through the door now, what would he say? Well, I'm not sure. I mean, it's a very fascinating thought experiment. But it's somehow not very helpful. Because the Buddha, or Jesus for that matter, were unavoidably creatures of their time. They grew up in this world. In the world in which they inhabited. They saw the world as the society would have seen it. We see the world in a way now that for us is self-evident. For example, if I start talking about DNA and the Big Bang and the molecules and atoms, everybody just goes, neural networks. But actually, we don't know unless you're an expert like John, you don't actually know what you're talking about. It's just that you take for granted a huge amount of common knowledge of your culture that comes with your mother's milk, basically. And so the Buddha grew up in that environment. So he can't walk through this door and then judge.
But if things are timeless in a sort of line of our relationship to existence, the physical scientific world shouldn't be relevant to the answer. It's a different, you bring in scientific stuff that, I mean, the Dalai Lama, for example, was asked, how would science prove some of these things wrong, his thoughts wrong, what would he do? He said he'd change it.
Yeah, but he doesn't.
He was confronted by historical things that showed the different readings and interpretations of when certain texts arose. He kind of evaded the question of Dalai Lama and his relationship with Wilson. Obviously a different question.
Yeah, no, I see your point, but I still am basically very sceptical about the idea of there being a kind of non-contingent, non-contextualized consciousness or knowing. That I think all human experience is somehow embedded and informed by the particular conditions of life in which you find yourself. And is there some sort of idealized theoretical stance that science would seek to celebrate, perhaps, a completely objective knowledge of what is the case. I'm very dubious about that. So hence I don't particularly want to go down the track, but it's also a thought experiment I do enjoy playing. But, let's just go down that track. Well, for a start, if the Buddha's starting point was conditioned arising, he would have just observe, presumably, that this is what has happened through cultural, religious, economic, social and change and conditions in India after his death until, let's say, the 12th century AD when Buddhism was ceased to exist in India. He would have seen, perhaps, how his teachings had actually played out in the real world. He may not have approved or disapproved of that. He would have just seen that as an illustration of what he was trying to teach. But of course there is a part of me that is more on perhaps on tune with what you suspect, and that is I feel that he would have noticed that many of the things that he had taught had subsequently been forgotten. That is, I think, something that he might have found disheartening. But again, I just find this whole sort of speculation not very helpful.
Yeah, I mean, I take your point, and I don't mean it just as a theoretical question. I'll sort of write something up. For example, if you want to aim at it's, for example, it's better than Buddhism in general.
So I can't hear you.
The Buddhism went to Buddhism, masculine root, you know, rather than, it just seems the teachings went male dominated, rather than sort of to the dominant, to the truth of existence, and it's just, you know,
yes, I think
sexism in the Buddhism, it's kind of quite shocking that there's been no female, and I'm not trained, just looking at it practically, there's been no female Dalai Lama. I mean, why? It's all the incarnation from the male side. You know, you look at the sexism of the monks and the way they've treated women in monasteries. That's not what the Buddha would have wanted.
No, it's certainly not. It's certainly.
Jesus would be upset about that as well.
No, it's certainly not what the Buddha had in mind.
Yeah.
But the Buddha was also a realist. He understood that the conditions of the world are such that certain outcomes are going to be more likely than others, given certain starting points. And I think it's probably fair to say that when the Buddha died, he might well have thought that his mission had failed in some ways. The last months of the Buddha's life can be reconstructed quite accurately, at least on the basis of textual information. And you really get the sense that his world was falling apart, his Sangha was disintegrating to a considerable degree, his sponsors had either been killed or had turned against him. The world, which had been broadly at peace during his lifetime, was descending into chaos and war, and he was basically isolated and abandoned. So there's a good chance he thought the whole thing was, you know, wasn't going to work at all. again, same with Jesus. I mean, ending up on a cross, being killed as a criminal, is not wholly what they had in mind. But in a strange way, that those events somehow are part of the teaching as well. I think it's not, to me, the Buddha's teaching is not reducible to what you can read in the suttas, the texts, the discourses, but is also what you can infer from the way he led his life. In other words, his life is an example of what he's teaching, and arguably it's more telling at times than the actual words and phrases that come out of his mouth. Otherwise, if someone else has not asked a question yet, yes.
You mentioned the word intuitive a few times. I just wonder if you want to say any more about it, or is it quite obvious what intuitive means?
Well, it's not quite obvious what intuitive means, but you can take more or less any word of that order, and once you start poking at it, it doesn't become so obvious anymore. St. Augustine famously said, something about time. He says, I know perfectly well what time is, unless somebody asks me what time is. It's the same thing. Like words like intuition, we kind of know what they mean. But you try to define it, you get into all sorts of trouble. But basically what I'm meaning is intuitive in the sense of not, you know, rationally and deliberately thought out as a reasoned conclusion, but as a kind of sixth sense, a kind of inner feel for, and then it all gets very fuzzy and new agey, I'm afraid. People have defined intuition. Jung, for example, defined it quite clearly, but I'm using the word in a sort of fuzzy sense. And I just kind of assume that as people who share the same language, you kind of know what I mean. But ask me to define it and I will get into trouble. Yes?
I'm not sure quite how to phrase it. It's around the same, your comment, which is very interesting, about perhaps the stuff about rebirth could be what the Buddha grew up with.
Grew up with, yeah.
To this whole issue of rebirth, okay.
Well, never mind. I regularly get asked the question, you know, what about rebirth?
Yeah.
And I've thought about this for a lot, actually, because it's clearly a very integral part of all Buddhist traditions. There's no getting around that. And if you read the early suttas, it's the language in which a lot of what the Buddha speaks of is framed in. Like when he talks of the different levels of sainthood. Again, it's once returner, non-returner. It has to do with getting reborn again or not. So it's built into the whole fabric of the discourse. But my sense is that the importance of rebirth and karma, which kind of go together in a way, is that they locate our sense of our existence in a far greater scheme of things than just our short human life. I think, to me, the importance of those ideas, which I wouldn't challenge at all, is that if you believe that you had all these numerous past lives and that you will have potentially numerous future lives, that somehow serves to locate you in the cosmos in a way in which you feel a sense of indebtedness to the past and a sense of possibility for the future, not just in terms of your personal life. But you see, nowadays, I think that same function is served by many aspects of our scientific worldview. We have a much clearer understanding now of how human beings evolved over millions of years, in extreme detail. We have a sense of the past and how it gave rise to what we currently now experience as individuals and as a community. And we have also, I think, a much clearer sense of how our actions will have consequences after our death. And we can take a moral responsibility for future generations. With us being around or not is kind of irrelevant. And likewise in the past, we don't have to have been around as microorganisms or early, you know, dinosaurs or whatever, to be able to understand how that knowledge informs and locates our own existence here and now. So I think we're actually missing the point if we get into this business, is rebirth true or false? As soon as you get down that track, you open up a can of worms. Both philosophically, it's very difficult to understand how a non-physical cognition of some kind, consciousness, is able to to have any connection or relationship at all to a physical organism. Philosophically, that's just enormously difficult to understand. And then scientifically, in terms of what we now understand about the evolution of the human body, the central nervous system, the brain, and so on, we can account for consciousness as a function of a highly complex organism in constant interaction with a world. We don't need to posit some kind of specialized knowing or awareness or consciousness or bhavanga citta or whatever you call it that comes into consciousness, into the body at birth and then leaves at death. It's very difficult for us to live with that or work with those ideas anymore. At least I find it very difficult. And I think the purpose of the karma reincarnation story is actually about having a broader sense of one's life within the cosmos. That's how I would take it. Yes? You speak up a little louder. It's very difficult to hear in this room.
Relating to the whole birth and rebirth question, and also I think earlier you mentioned the whole idea of classifying the Buddha's teaching as sort of culturally specific to his time, mm-hmm. as sort of more universal. I find this approach very appealing, but I think there's a very danger here of taking what we like and say, oh, that's mm-hmm. universal. Yeah. And take what we might have trouble with, say, like rebirth, and say, oh, it was clearly a cultural artifact. Yeah. So how do you approach this question in a more meaningful and more honest way, rather than just...
Well, I take that, this is a common criticism. Is you don't believe in rebirth because you just don't like the idea. It doesn't make sense to you, but does that mean it's somehow irrelevant? Well, as I've said, I would not reject it out of hand, but try to understand it as a function of the society of that time. But more importantly, I think, to me, the real center of the Buddha's teaching, which I alluded to here, is this question of fully embracing suffering. Now, frankly, that's not, on the face of it, a terribly agreeable thing to have to do. It's actually demanding an enormous amount. I don't think it's a soft sell or a watering down. Rather, the contrary. So there you have a teaching which is arguably also not palatable, and yet is, I think, more and more, I feel, to lie at the very core of what the whole Dharma is about, and that is actually deeply challenging, as this idea of nirvana, as responding to life uninflected by reactivity. Again, that's not easy. And it might sound like a nice idea, but to actually try to live these things, you become acutely aware of how, instinctively and naturally, you're pushing in totally the opposite direction. So, you could argue that if you reduce Buddhism to just, becoming a little bit more mindful and being a little bit more chilled, it'll make your life in any condition that much more less stressful, perhaps. And to me, that would be that alone would be, a considerable diminishing, if not an outright distortion, of what, in fact, the Buddha is trying to impart. So, I do think we have to bear that concern in mind. Come in. Could you shut all the doors, please?
It's hot.
It's hot, and I'm sorry about that, but we're just nearly finishing. Yes, one last question, and then we have to stop.
Thank you. This builds on the previous two questions and your answers, and perhaps ask a little further, which is, would you tie it all a bit to the concept of dependent origination? So to speak about that conceptually, and also the choice of translation in English.
Of that term.
Conditionalizing, dependent origination, but also, of course, like, again, going back to
Reverb as an extension, explanation of it, or how do you see those two in relation to each other? Okay, I'll try and get this done in 5 minutes and then stop. I think that there's an implication in what you say that conditioned arising, dependent origination is classically framed within the 12 links of dependent origination, which does imply past and future lives. Ignorance and karma of past life, name and form consciousness, and everything up to clinging is this life, and then birth, sickness, aging, death is in the future life. So there is, I don't know whether that's implied in your question, but certainly dependent origination, when it's teased out into the 12 links, is also phrased in past life, future life, metaphysics, basically. But, again, one of the things that you can do with these ideas is you can see how the term evolved in the body of the earliest texts that we have. And it seems to me fairly convincing that the idea of dependent origination as a series of nidanas or links started in a text called the Kahala Vivada Sutta in the Atakavaga, which is in the chapter, which is in the Sutta Nipata. Does this make sense? In other words, the Atakavaga is considered to be the earliest portion, or one of the earliest portions, of the Pali Canon. It's written in a very different kind of Pali. It's an archaic meter, etc. So there's other reasons too.
Okay.
But in any case, the Kahala Vivada Sutta is the first time that we get this sense of nidanas or links. In other words, taking the principle of conditioned arising and then specifying a sequence of causes and effects. But in the Kahala Vivada Sutta, there are only 6 or 7, depending on how you break it up, links, and none of them have anything to do with past and future lives. In fact, the question the Buddha starts with is why is there conflict in the world? Why is there disagreement? Why is there conflict and disagreement in the world? And he then analyzes that back to, basically the condition we are in, what he calls nama rupa, name and form, that gives rise to contact, that gives rise to feeling, that gives rise to desire, that gives rise to... So you get the middle section as an analysis of human conflict. It looks very likely, therefore, that the earlier bits and the later bits were added on at a subsequent date. There's also 2 suttas in the Pali Canon where you just get 10 links, not 12. First 2 are omitted. It starts with consciousness and nama rupa, but then it does go on to birth, sickness, aging, death. So my sense is that the idea, the doctrine of the 12 links evolved in the decades, centuries after the Buddha's death, in order to somehow fit his teaching more convincingly and more usefully in the soteriology means the way we think about liberation or salvation within the Indian subcontinent of that period. That's my theory, that the 12-link model gave the Buddhists a kind of their own particular explanation for how the world is the way it is. And But my problem with that is that you already can see that Buddhism is becoming more concerned with explaining how things are rather than giving us a set of tools and practices to change how we live. My own hunch, and it might be wrong, is that Buddhism started out as a practice-based ethics, and it evolved or mutated into a truth-based metaphysics. And the 12 links is a good example of, you could actually track how that doctrine evolved. As for the translation, I don't like conditioned arising, I don't like dependent origination. This is Buddhist jargon, really. If I go out onto the street and say, what do you think about conditioned arising? But what is a better word? Perhaps I sometimes use just the word conditionality, that's a little bit better. Contingency, maybe. Cause and effect, even, actually. Causality. But I don't think we really have a word in English that is both idiomatic, in other words, that people would use in everyday speech, and captures what's intended by the term in the original text. And this is the great struggle that those of us who write and teach and translate are always facing, is how do we find an idiomatic English and yet remain sufficiently precise to be faithful to the original text? And that's a work in progress, and I'm afraid I can't sort that out this evening. Thank you very much.